Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This week, we're delving into the world of artificial intelligence and machine vision with the CEO and co-founder of Always AI. So Marty Beard is an incredible executive. He has seen some amazing things in high-tech history. He was vice president of Oracle Online, president of Sybase 365, chairman and CEO of his own live ops company, chief executive officer of BlackBerry, and is now a co-founder and CEO of Always AI. You don't have to go far to read and hear about how artificial intelligence is changing everything. And I've always wondered how it works and what it can be used for outside of ChatGPT. And Marty has some amazing examples of how this is being used in stores, in restaurants, in mines. And I think it'll really pique your interest, hopefully stimulate some ideas, and give you a bit more confidence in knowing this particular part of what's happening in the world of digital to physical convergence.
The Mr. Beacon Ambient IoT podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, bringing intelligence to every single thing.
So Marty, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you.
So I'd love it if you can start off just by introducing us to your company. You're the co-founder and CEO of Always AI. What does your company do?
Yeah, we're a vision AI company. So what does that mean? We have a software platform that allows companies to build computer vision applications. And there's a lot involved in that process, but build computer vision applications and then actually get them out on the edge running, right? So they can collect data from cameras that are out in the real world that'll help them run their business. So we're the software platform that gives you an end-to-end capability to build computer vision apps, run those apps 24/7 out in the real world, and then get all that data that people are really after to help them make better business decisions. That's Always AI.
And are you building a platform that other people will develop on, or would you go to General Motors and kind of give them a turnkey solution?
Yeah, we do both. It's a great question. So in some cases, the customer, they have IT departments, they have developers, and they're going to basically use our platform to create those applications themselves and get it running out on their cameras and so forth, everything the platform enables. That's great. Right. And it's built for them to just go crazy, prototype, build as many apps as you want, get them out onto as many cameras as you want. Other cases, a lot of cases, actually, the customer will say, hey, I don't really have a whole bunch of folks, but I definitely need to do this. Can you guys actually provide the solution? And then in that case, my engineering team will work with the business people and we'll build the AI model, we'll train the model, we'll develop the application to their specs, we'll actually get it out running on the cameras and so forth. So it's both.
And it seems like you probably have one of the classic entrepreneurial problems of you probably have some great technology, but it can be used for a million different things.
Right.
What have you decided to focus on as the, yeah, as the key use cases?
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Well, it turned out that there's a couple of industries or verticals that are early adopters, right? So one is the industrial space, and specifically mining and manufacturing, turned out to be early adopters of computer vision. And you probably wouldn't have picked that if you were building a, you know, business from scratch, but it was like, oh, I get it. You know, if you think about mining, it's under a lot of pressure because we need to get more and more of these metals out of the earth. Why? Because everybody's buying electric vehicles and we're all using iPhones and, you know, laptops and so forth. And all of that relies on metals. But they need to run those mines more efficiently. So cameras can show them where they're being inefficient or where they're having issues or problems and maybe labor constraints or what have you. Also, health and safety. Same thing with manufacturing. We work, for example, with a lumber manufacturer, and they want to understand how efficient are they cutting lumber and how safely are they cutting lumber and are they getting the kind of output that they need to get? Are they catching anomalies or mistakes before they become a real problem? So industrial is one space that we really focus on a lot. The other one, almost 180 from that, is retail. So retail's obsessed with what? With customers. How many customers do I have? Where are they going in my store? What brands are they most focused on, right? So there's all the customer analytics for a retailer, but also what's called behind the counter. So for example, if you're a restaurant, how efficiently am I making stuff? Like, am I, quote, manufacturing a sandwich or a pizza as quickly and efficiently as I can? So these are two areas that are really hot. It's all about operational improvement. It's all about getting real-time data, like real-time insight, so you can act on what's actually happening, and right, you can catch problems before they become big issues. And this is where computer vision really thrives.
So how would your product help Subway monitor the sandwich making process, yeah, in a way that can be actioned and acted on?
Yeah. Yeah. So we do things like we can actually assess what's called the average traversal time from the very beginning of that process of making the sandwich to the very end. How long did that take on average? Mm-hmm. And if you know that number, then you can benchmark different Subway stores against each other. You can say, okay, this store right here does that in 2.5 minutes and they have really good results and they sell a lot of sandwiches. This one over here seems they're in the 5.5 minute mark. That's twice the other guy. Why? Like, what's going on, right? There's something going on there. And then they can diagnose it, which they literally do by zone. So one zone might be bread and the other zone is condiments and the other zone is meats. So they can start to drill down into, oh, we're really starting to have a problem right here in this one section. Let's fix it. So that's a simple example, but that's a real example. So before that, it was human beings trying to figure it out, or you might look at weekly or monthly data and try to understand what's going on. Now you're just literally getting it real time on a dashboard, and you can see the dashboard, and you can make decisions based off that real time data.
I think as an employee, I would have mixed feelings about this. On one hand, I'd feel like, oh, this is good because this AI is impartial and dispassionate. Yeah. And just because, you know, I've got my hair parting. Well, my hair parting is a complete mess, but it's going to judge me objectively. Yeah. And then the flip side is the obvious Big Brother thing. Yeah. I'm sure you have had to deal with that. Yep. I can't imagine that unions love this, but I guess probably a lot of fast food shops, very few are unionized, so maybe that's not so much of an issue.
But. No, but but construction sites and mines and others are. No, it's a great question, and it's an issue that needs to be addressed. So on the privacy side, let's start with that. You can't identify somebody by name, right? You can't do that. In fact, in every situation, that I've mentioned and others that I can tell you about, you have to blur faces, right? So you literally, as part of the computer vision application, you're blurring the actual identity of a person working there. You need to protect their personal identity, but the camera is identifying, okay, that's a specific individual and they're here in this zone and, you know, and so forth. So there is that level of detail, but it's an important issue and the company needs to be upfront about how the data is being used and so forth. Now, on the flip side of that, which is what is interesting and not expected, is that what companies have started to do is there's upside in the sense of if you use this tool accurately, there's bonuses, you're almost like gamifying the process. You're kind of like, hey, store A, you guys can make a little bit more money than store B because you're performing better, right? So then there's this awareness that like, okay, I can use that tool to actually potentially improve the performance of the store, and maybe that filters down to everybody that's involved in that. But these are real issues that the industry is working out. We worked with, did some work with Burger King in Europe, which has very strong rules and regulations around personal identity and so forth. And Burger King wanted to know exactly how long it took from the time somebody entered the door, they ordered their meal, they picked up the bag and they left. So again, that amount of time. But we had to blur like literally everybody's face, and the person is identified just by a number. There's no, you have no idea that's Marty Beard or Steve, or you don't know that. It's just a number. But these are real issues, and these are issues that I think AI in general is dealing with, and then computer vision specifically is going to have to deal with.
Can you give feedback to an individual employee? You know, there's an AI company that kind of monitors sales calls and tells people, oh, you're talking too much, and try using, you know, the best performing people use this word. Can you do the same for sandwich production or wood production? Can you be a coach?
Well, in the case of, like, for example, mining, if somebody is being unsafe, right, which is a real, I mean, that's a real issue. This is not like somebody that's going to stub their toe, right? This is like something bad may happen. Then, you absolutely want to take action on that particular person, and you would know that particular person because the camera is saying there's a person that's not roped in appropriately in that area right there, and you go take care of it. Or in the restaurant example I gave earlier, let's say the dashboard is showing a manager that we're really having backup in the bread section. Like, for some reason, we're having backup in the bread section. You're going to go to the bread section and talk to the person there and say, what's going on? It may be, oh, I don't have enough bread. Oh, okay. You know, let me help you out. So yeah, you can definitely take action in real time based on what you're seeing.
And can you talk a bit more about the retail applications? That tends to be a vertical that, you know, we cover. Sure. IoT, digital physical convergence, but for some reason, I think it's basically just because I'm super interested in retail. But what are the other retail applications?
We do work with Lazy Boy furniture outlets. You may have heard of those. Okay. And, you know, that's called specialty retail. So we were just talking about restaurants, but now we're into so-called specialty retail, furniture stores, hardware stores, you know, things like that. They have a very simple need, which is who's coming in, how many people are coming in, where are they going in the store, and am I assigning the right salesperson to that person that came in? So you would say, oh, couldn't a human being do that? Some of these stores are enormous. Right. And so they want to know, okay, that person came in, they're very interested in couches. The right salesperson is Dave. Let's get Dave over there to go meet with that person, et cetera. And so it's just a little bit more real time kind of ability to mix and match appropriately human beings, you know, the customer to the right salesperson. We're in about 80 of those stores now. And also, obviously, they're understanding who's coming in, how many people are coming in, demographics of the people coming in. They're starting to understand a lot more about their customer base and their prospect base.
Fascinating.
So that's a simple application, but it's sophisticated computer vision. These are deep learning AI models that are deployed out in the facility, and you know, there's a lot of technology that goes behind that.
And how are you delivering the prompts, the nudges to the staff to look after someone who's been roaming around in the mattress area?
Yeah, they have a dashboard that they're using. The manager can literally see color coded, you know, all that information about how many and where and zones and so forth is kind of captured in a nice nice dashboard that is put together by our partner, which is called a company called Trackwell. So we partner with Trackwell, which is really focused on that analytics presentation. We're all the AI magic behind that. Yeah. It's kind of feeding that. And so it's a dashboard. Just think of an iPad where somebody has it and they can see what's going on.
And with retail, there's obviously a lot of technology there, but also the buyers are famously unimpressed by technology for technology's sake. How do you sell to a company like that?
It's going to be, you're absolutely right. In fact, the buyers, that would apply to all industries. It's, you know, but retail, very tight margins and don't want anything that gets in the way of efficiency and meeting those margins. Yeah, you need to demo here. This is what it does. And this is how you will get ROI from this application. I guess it's ironic. If you're running a computer vision company, you better visually show people how it's going to help them. You can't hold up a PowerPoint and say, I would like to talk to you about vision, right? So you need to show people that. Humans are very visual, and I think they get it. You know, when they see it, they kind of get it. We'll do very simple proofs of concept for people where if you just put up one camera, by the way, I should even mention, in most cases, they already have the cameras.
Yeah.
They're already using it. You know, those black, you see the camera up in the ceiling. It's probably just doing simple security footage. But you can get to that camera through Always AI, and then you could do much more sophisticated computer vision off that camera. So you just quickly set it up and showcase counting people, zone analysis. You know, it's easy to set up a few zones and go from there. And then I think, you know, when people kind of go, oh, I get it. Okay, all right, can you do this? Can you do that? And now you're getting into the more sophisticated needs.
And so what was your approach to getting that deal? Did you say, look, we think there's an opportunity in specialty retail and we're going to find this partner and we're going to create a demo and then we're going to go and call on all the specialty retailers?
You got it. That's okay. Well put. Literally our partner Trackwell already had some experience with Lazy Boy. And saw an opportunity to provide them more sophisticated AI. They know us. And so they said, hey, let's go in. We demoed. And you just laid it out exactly. It was kind of like, okay, that's what we need. And then we worked and we built it. And then we started in a couple of early stores, optimized the application. You know, AI is very dynamic, right? It's garbage in, garbage out. It's all based on the model, right? So you want a model that's really optimize for the specific use case. And that optimization process takes time, right? You need to get out in the real world and you need to collect that data and you need to look at it and try it and then refine it and so forth. So we did that in the early stores. And now we're in a very cha-ching, 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 just roll it out store by store.
And can this technology be used to combat shrink? That seems to be one of the big issues in retail. Can you spot people that to steal things?
Yeah, you could. You could also, shrinkage also could be, for example, like in the case of you know, a fast casual restaurant like a Mendocino Farms or a quick service restaurant like McDonald's or so forth. They're just maniacal about not wasting food or not wasting things. So wastage is kind of similar. It's like, let's not waste food, right? So cameras are fantastic at that, right? You can really analyze, we're wasting here and not here, and so forth. And then obviously shrinkage, that's more of a security. You could potentially have the cameras on the checkout, self-checkout, which is where a lot of that seems to happen. you could use cameras there, but we're not a security company per se. We can help with security, but that's not really our forte.
And what does the deployment look like in terms of the infrastructure? You introduced your company as Edge. You used the word mm-hmm. Edge a couple of times. So I have local servers. With a lot of NVIDIA GPUs or...
Yeah. So maybe in this case, let's back up from what happened. So I'll just take the case of, let's take some real cases. So like Lazy Boy, okay, there are cameras, right? Let's say there's 4 to 5 cameras. These are just simple, what are called IP cameras. They're able to hook up to the internet, right? They can accept Wi-Fi, they can, et cetera. Those are the cameras. They're capturing images. Those camera feeds go to what's called an edge device, right? And a brand that is everybody knows called, you know, NVIDIA sells edge devices. So do a lot of other people. I'm just using NVIDIA as an example. And they have a line of products called Jetsons. They're these boxes. They're about this big. And the camera feeds into the box. And what's the box doing? The box actually has the AI model, the actual model is there, and it's leveraging the GPUs, the graphical processing unit sitting in the NVIDIA box, and it's taking the camera feeds in, and it's applying the model that was built. How many people? Where are those people? Demographics of the people? What zones are they in? Whatever the model was that was built, if the magic's happening literally on that device. And so, if I'm backing up, and then Always AI is the platform that built the app, deployed the app, put it all on that device to actually give you that real-time feed. Okay. Now, in some cases, you got the cameras, and instead of going to an edge device, they're going to the cloud, right? So a company might say, I don't want to put out an edge hardware. I just want to go directly to the cloud. That's fine. And we do a lot of that. The only problem with that is it's expensive, right? Because the cloud is going to charge you for the inference, right? Cha-ching, cha-ching, yeah. Cha-ching. Every time, yeah. You know, the inference is just the logic. It's just saying, is that a person? Is that a person? Is that a person? And that's cha-ching, 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 right? In the cloud on an edge device, there's no charge for that. It just runs 24/7. There's no charge. But that's the generic architecture. You got cameras connected to either an edge device or the cloud. And then you've got the magic happening, the AI algorithm, I call it the magic, is either literally happening in that edge device or in the cloud. And the magic is all created and built by Always AI in our situation.
And how expensive are those NVIDIA devices?
Again, going backwards, the cameras, you know, I mean, literally cameras now are like, what, $70, $100?
Right. I'm assuming that's free. That's already there. I'm just thinking about the
and
servers.
And then the edge devices are, you know, these are $700, $800, $900, something like that. But okay. they can feed many, many cameras. If you want to get to a beefier box that can do more and run faster and have more GPUs, then now you're into maybe a couple thousand dollars. But you know, in the case of Lazy Boy, they're not even using NVIDIA; they're using a different product. And in their case, it's an edge device, and I think it runs somewhere around $130, something like that.
Well,
so it's the edge cost. This is Moore's law, right? Which you and I have seen. It's like the power goes up, the cost goes down. AI magic can happen now on the edge. It couldn't, you know, 5 years ago. It was really difficult. Now you can do it.
Interesting. So I remember, I'm sort of interested in your opinion on maybe an adjacent application for same technology, Amazon Fresh, all of the cameras looking at the basically streamlining payment, which just seems amazing. And I guess I should ask you if that's something that you have worked on. But one of the criticisms there is hardware is really expensive because you have to have so many cameras and you can't just use the security cameras. And you've got to have like a lot of compute to do that level of processing. Is that a valid criticism or is that just
fun? No, it is. It is. Yeah, I think in that specific case, the way that Amazon went about it, it's amazing, but it's really, really expensive the way that they did it. And if you've noticed, they've backed off that a bit and kind of shut down some of those stores and kind of backed off. Because I think the way they did it is you literally have probably hundreds of cameras in there. Now, we did it a very different way. We have some experience with what's called contactless checkout. All of us have seen this now. We all got used to like going to a Target or something, and then we self-checkout, right? It's all barcode scanning. And what's happened is now people are really looking at different modalities of contactless checkout, where you don't interact with a human being. You take your items. Most people don't have 100 items. We have 10 or less. And you put them down on something, cameras look at it, immediately identify it, you tap your phone, you walk out, right? RFID tags are another way that people are doing that. That's not computer vision, that's a different technology. So I think there's a lot of effort and money going into making that process faster. The way that Amazon went about it, I think was amazing and like, but too expensive to really roll out big time, right? And I think people are still working on this challenge. We did do a lot of work, like I said, in contactless checkout and interesting, difficult computer vision challenge for sure.
Yeah, there's an Amazon Fresh store near where we both live. It's just inland from you and just south of me in the Carlisle Mountain area. And it's just been sitting there and they haven't turned it on. It's like very frustrating. I kind of want to experience this.
Yeah.
Where would you say this part of AI is in terms of crossing the chasm?
I think it's in the middle of that process. It's got a couple of, you know, maybe the way to answer it is, it's very different from, for example, generative AI and kind of open AI, right? So that's all of us have browsers. We boot up our browser, we go to, you know, ChatGPT, and we interface with it, and we have that kind of magic. But that's looking backwards. It's historical. So it's grabbing data that already exists out in the world on the internet and pulling it together for you in this amazing human-like manner, right? And so it's almost like Wikipedia on steroids. It's kind of like, I'm just going to pull together information from you, or I'm going to generate information for you. But the way I'm doing that is I'm looking, it's a mirror on the past, right? I'm just grabbing information that already exists and I'm going to present it to you. Okay, when you get into computer vision, this is literally real-time new data that does not exist, right? So this is what's happening now. This is not ChatGPT, which goes up to November of 2022 or whatever the cutoff date on the model is. So now you're dealing with kind of real-time information, and you also have hardware, right? So you've got physics, you have atoms or on, you know, you've got metal devices, cameras, you've got drones, you've got cars, you have things that are literally out there that are also, you know, have to be enabled to take this AI and make it work for you to get that real-time data. So my point being, it's more complex, and the industry is working its way through the best ways to do that, the most optimal ways to do that, the cheapest ways to do that, right? And so we're all versus, you know, OpenAI, which I can jealously look at as, you know, it didn't have to worry about that because everybody has a browser on their laptop, their iPad, their phone. They already, and it's literally just accessing magic through that. This is, you got to get it running on a physical device. And then from there, you need to collect that information and then present it, right? So it's a little bit tougher. So I did a long answer to your question, but I think we're in the middle of that process.
So this is an area that Elon Musk is famously very keen on. So kind of jettisoning all these extra sensors from the cars and just focusing on the camera input. And one of the things that he uses to kind of bolster the perceived value of Tesla is the corpus of training data they have. They're gathering more training data than anyone else. Is that something, well, first of all, do you buy that argument? And does that apply to always AI? Do you see you building a kind of a barrier to entry because you just have more hours of video streaming into your system?
No. Well, so first question, I do buy his argument, because the more data you have, the more training you can do, the better the model will react and therefore be able to predict. And that's just an ongoing thing. And in his case, and in the case of like OpenAI, they're dealing with massive data sets. Like, you know, I think I read it, something like more molecules in the, you know, more than molecules in the ocean. It's kind of like just massive, massive, massive data sets. And yeah, the more data, the better the predictions will be, right? In our case, in computer vision, the models are much smaller. Right. So just physically smaller. They don't take as much room and as needed on those situations. That's a really important distinction. And why is that? Because you can train a computer vision model off a relatively small set to do exactly what you need it to do. Right. That's one of the reasons it can actually get on a physical device that's not a massive server sitting in a data center somewhere. It's literally on a smaller device. What's unique about us is our end-to-end capability. We are totally unique in that you can go all the way from collecting data to build the model, train the model, build your specific application, literally get it out running on a camera and get the data, that whole end-to-end process. You can log into Always AI and do all of it. By the way, you can do it all remotely. So if you're on 100 cameras out in 10 different locations, you can see everything going on there just from your desktop or your laptop. So that's our uniqueness, is the end-to-end. It's not really a data, you know, like a data model battle as much as it is actually a practical AI implementation.
And so what's next for you guys from an R&D perspective? Where are you taking the product?
So we're the biggest thing for us is what's called multimodal. Tech loves to come up with expressions that are like sound cool. And so multimodal, all that means is another mode, in our case, for example, sound, gets combined with vision to make the application even better. So for example, in a mining scenario, I'm not only seeing what's happening, I can actually hear what's happening, which could be really important in a mine. Things are exploding and, you know, there's noises that are important. I can combine that into a synthesized AI model that's even better, even smarter, and even more human-like, because all of us are seeing and hearing and so forth. So we just announced this, that we're able to handle multimodal capabilities. So we've gone from vision to sound, to now we're starting to deal with text and large language models and so forth, which are also starting to find their way into our world. So that's super exciting, because now it becomes really a AI platform, not just a vision platform, but again, still very focused on practically getting it working. Mm-hmm. Right? We are not the guys that are in the back office just doing data science work. This is like, we want to take that work and then we want to get it out and get it working in the real world. So super exciting. Multimodal.
So multimodal, does that include text, the conversations that people are having in?
That would.
Okay.
Yeah, that would. Yep. You could start building in voice into the model. You could build in text into the model. You could build in sound coming from sensors. So all of this is getting fed somehow by a sensor, right? But you know, it's obviously heading our way, and we can see that in some of our early adopters and so forth.
And what about text? So I that seems like a separate thing. So can you unpack that?
So text is being used for, so the very beginning of this whole process of any AI is the model that you develop, right? You know, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, you want that to be as good as you can get. And building a model is an art form, because you have to, you know, you collect images, you annotate images, you're trying to train something, look for this, right? there's a whole category called synthetic data, which is you know, data that's not, quote, real video images from the real world. It's just coming off the internet. And what's happening is you're now starting to be able to use text to describe what kind of synthetic data set you want. Please give me 50 images of people walking in a shoe store and looking at Nikes, right? And then you get a synthetic representation of that. And then that helps you make your model better. Now, you also have real images of people walking in stores and looking at Nikes, but now you can also augment it with this synthetic data. It just makes everything faster and kind of gets to the magic quicker. So that's super interesting because it's starting to marry the unreal world with the real world, the synthetic with kind of the real world.
Amazing. Well, Marty, it's been a real pleasure. We've got a whole other chat to this conversation where we delve into your amazing history. You have been part of some amazing companies, seen some amazing things. Yes, thanks very much for talking about Always AI.
Thank you. That was great.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Marty, you've had an amazing career spanning Oracle, Sybase, COO, BlackBerry, co-founder CEO of Always AI. And I always look, if someone's worked at Oracle, that's quite a thing in my mind, because Larry Ellison runs a tight ship and they're like, yeah, just legendary. How did you get to be vice president at Oracle, and what were you doing there?
Maybe it was just, I got lucky on the timing, who knows, but this is really early in my career, and the web is really having a big impact on e-commerce and all kinds of business applications. And Larry decided that he wanted to see how much of his sales he could do online, right? So he was tired of having to rely on this huge sales force, you know, of human beings, right? that would go out and try to sell Oracle database and
A legendary sales force, though. Legendary for being very, very effective.
Yep. Yeah. And at the time that I got there, they were doing a lot of consulting under a gentleman named Ray Lane, famous executive at Oracle. And Larry was sort of wanted to get back to software sales and try to make it a more direct sale. And I was in a group that was focused on doing that for small to medium-sized businesses. It was called Oracle Online. And it was all about, you know, selling database licenses online and really leveraging the web to do that. So it was a fascinating project. Larry was very involved in it. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and they had a great opportunity to not only work with him, but just work with a wide variety of amazing talent at Oracle. And we did pretty well. We sold a lot of database online. So it was kind of the start of that more online sales, and that became just normal within the enterprise software space.
And how would you describe his management approach? He's like this zealot character that pops up whenever you watch any documentary about Silicon Valley, whether it's about Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or whatever, and he kind of appears as a feature character, but what's he actually like when he's working on a new project like this?
My very first meeting that involved him, there was a bunch of people in a room in the boardroom, and he found out that there was a group of people in Sacramento that were taking orders off fax machines and then rekeying them, and he fired them all. So as I was sitting in the meeting thinking, okay, this is how things roll. So he found this massive inefficiency, and he got upset about that, and that wasn't even on the agenda. It was just, that just happened, right? And then and I later found out, I said, is you know what happened? And it was like, yeah, some people got impacted, not everybody, but he did find something that shouldn't have been there. The other thing I noticed about him is he would make decisions like that very, very quickly. People would come in and spend a month on PowerPoints and put them in front of him, and they'd be perfect, and he would not look at them. He would just talk and just immediately get to the key issue and immediately resolve it. So very quick, very focused, very smart.
How do you prepare to deal with someone like that?
I think you go in just knowing your subject matter from every angle that you can think of, right? And so if it was pricing, you know, online, what are we selling the database for? How are we pricing it? You know, what are the different permutations, et cetera? You just need to make sure that you had all that covered. I found him, like, you know, obviously he's legendary for his temper and all kinds of things. And outside of that situation I just mentioned, I didn't really see it that much. It was more very, very business focused, very, very get to the essence of the problem and try to figure out how to fix it. So I found it good training, you know, to see that.
So it must have been a little scary dealing with someone who just fired a bunch of people because they were just doing the wrong thing at all. But
yeah.
But did you feel like, did you have space to actually perform and
yeah.
be creative?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And again, this is me as part of a team. This is not, you know, Marty Beer sitting there having this one-on-one with Larry Ellison. That was not happening. But yeah, I think the team, look, Oracle, a lot of really smart people. Larry hired really, really smart people from a lot of different backgrounds. Definitely a technology-oriented place, high value of engineering backgrounds and so forth. And just a lot of people around the table that are just smart. Larry moves really fast. Honestly, he's probably the smartest guy sitting in the room. I think everybody actually knows that, not just because he owns the company and is that multi-billionaire, but actually really, really smart and fast. So you're on your toes, you know your subject. And then, you know, I'll give you another simple example. Is a lot of people were building a website to try to make the interface better for the customer and so forth. And Larry walks into his office and boots up and asks somebody to go to Amazon.com, which was relatively early then. And he said, why are we redoing things? Do you think they know how to make things work where they're selling directly to customers? And we're like, oh, yeah. Books, yes. Beyond books, yes. Why are we redoing this? That's probably a paradigm that we should follow. Just follow that. So we all
Very
walked out.
Practical.
We're like, well, that makes sense. That's
yeah.
practical. You know, they've yeah. probably figured this out. Maybe there's some things there that are best practice that we can learn from, et cetera. It's just an example. Very practical guy.
So are there things from working in that environment? I realize this is kind of one relatively small part of your career, just a few years. But as you're the CEO now, you're kind of in his position. Is there a set of things that you learned from him that you're putting into practice, and are there a set of things that you said, I'm not gonna do that, you know?
I think definitely a set of things from him. And then after him, I worked for a gentleman named John Chen for many years, also incredibly smart and very operationally focused and so forth. Yeah, I think learning that in a meeting it's just completely focused on the business problem. Right. That came across really clearly from Larry and John, and really trying to understand the business problem, focus on that. That's the most important thing. Talk, get the right people around the table, talk about the problem, try to resolve it and move on to the next problem. So I guess, you know, focus and really focusing on the right issue, not a lot of just smoke around the issue or things that are kind of tangential to what you're trying to trying to accomplish. I think on the other hand, however, and I would say especially my experience at Sybase and so forth, maybe I try to also focus a little bit more on innovation and kind of also allowing time for people to really, especially when you're talking about roadmaps and the future. So it's not so much here's a business problem we need to solve. It's more about where's the market going and what kind of innovation do we need to focus on? That's a very different process, right? And that's something that's really, really critical to add that juice into the system. So you know, you've got the new innovative technology that you need because the market just constantly moves, right? If you're only focused on the box of existing business problems, you're going to miss the next box, right? So I think, you know, try to do those two things, wear those different hats at the right time.
Got it. So how did you end up transitioning to Sybase? Obviously, it was a promotion, so I imagine that featured in
I think for me, you know, after 3-4 years at Oracle, I think Oracle had reached this point where it was at that time just one of the most highly valued companies in tech, and was really one of the picks and shovels for everybody going after .com. Right, you were using an Oracle database probably on a Sun Microsystems machine, and you were. That they were just riding that wave. It kind of felt like not tapped out, but like, okay, that we're just going to do this forever. I ran across Sybase, which had competed with Oracle in the database space, but for a whole variety of reasons had kind of gotten beat up a bit and was really looking to reinvent itself. And John Chen had come in as the CEO and was really in a place of like, okay, I'm going to make some moves. I'm going to acquire some companies. I'm going to really head into more. And he needed some strategic thinking, something that I'd always been really strong at, and just wanted somebody to help him kind of make those moves. And it just seemed like such a unique opportunity that I grabbed it. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience.
You were there for a long time. What do you look upon as some of your biggest achievements?
I mean, we transformed a company that was a, you know, database company that was having a hard time growing into a fast growing mobile enterprise company. So, it was literally pivoting from kind of a stable, but having a hard time growing database business. Cause again, Oracle was really winning and but taking that base and the cash that you were able to generate from that and then move into mobile enterprise and really take it a bet. Now it's just obvious, like our businesses are run on our mobile phones. But at that time, it was a fairly big move. It was like, okay, I'm going to approve POs and approve, you know, run my HR systems and financial systems. I'm able to do that on a mobile device. So we made a huge move, you know, under John's leadership and others to move into mobile enterprise. We bought a lot of companies. We repositioned the branding. Reposition the technology capabilities, reposition the Salesforce, the partner ecosystem, the whole thing. And what happened at the end of that is SAP bought us. And for a very high premium, it was a huge payoff for Sybase shareholders and for the management team. So it was a fun experience.
Amazing. And that success gave you the platform to move up to chairman and CEO of LiveOps.
Yeah. Yeah. I think coming out of that experience, the Sybase experience, it was like, all right, I've worn a lot of different hats, done a lot of exciting things, had a big success as part of a great team and all that stuff. Now I want to go do it myself, right? I want to see if I can be CEO of, and you know, I had run a large division of Sybase. It was like a $250 million business, but not as CEO, right? I really wanted to do that. And LiveOps was a super interesting company that was run by a gentleman named Maynard Webb. And Maynard had come, he was a pretty famous guy that had come out of eBay. And he got fascinated by LiveOps as kind of it was a lot of people that worked out of their houses and it was sort of labor on demand. In some ways it was a precursor of like thinking of like Uber was kind of transportation on demand. This was like labor on demand, and not outsourcing, but actually literally on demand. Like, I need somebody for 4 hours. I need somebody for 6 hours. That was super interesting. And then the platform that LiveOps had built was used by a lot of call centers and customer service. Super interesting. And it was trying to leverage social and all kinds of different channels. So yeah, it was a fun opportunity for me to come in and run the company and become chairman of the board and go through that process. Great VCs were invested in it. And ran that for quite a while.
And so what persuaded you to go to BlackBerry, and where were they in their incredibly storied history? I mean, this is a company that was just a colossus at one point. I remember when I first joined my first startup, I left. Yeah. IBM bought the company I worked at. Okay. I'm like, okay, now's the time when I get to go from being a director to being a VP and running sales and everything. And first thing I got from our CEO, who was just an amazingly gifted guy, was a BlackBerry device. And that was the iconic kind of accessory that you had when you were going to Sand Hill Road and doing all the things that you do.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, come on. It's a iconic brand, right? And really had established the smartphone space. But when I got involved in that, so what happened was John Chen, who I mentioned earlier and had run Sybase, he was asked to turn, which would, you know, obviously Sybase, that was a really successful turnaround. He had been asked to inject the same magic at BlackBerry. And they'd gone to an outsider, and by that I mean a non-Canadian, you know, it's a Canadian company, BlackBerry, and it was like, okay, we're going to bring in some Californians here, and the whole job was to pivot from hardware only into software, right? Hardware's really hard, and smartphones, you know, Apple obviously had kicked butt and was quickly becoming the de facto leader. And you had a lot of Android devices and all kinds of things going on. And BlackBerry was trying to find its way in that. Remember, it had made its name on keyboards, right? And Steve Jobs had famously held his hand up and said, "This is a keyboard; it's your fingers," right? And so, yeah. So John had come in to for that turnaround, and he asked me to come in as chief operating officer and kind of help him move away from the hardcore hardware manufacturing and so forth and get into cybersecurity software. BlackBerry was always known as a very secure device. The president used it, the CIA used it, you know, it was the lockdown secure device. And so I had to leverage that heritage into this cybersecurity software space. And so that I was involved in that whole pivot. It was literally a hardcore 180 move from vastly money-losing hardware business into a money-making pure software company and try to do that as fast as you can. So that was an interesting, fascinating, exhausting experience that I went through. But lucky to have gone through.
Very good. So you were part of history in, more than once in your high-tech history, more than once in your career. What is it that you think gives you this facility with strategy? What makes a good strategist, and what's your approach?
You know, I like thinking about patterns that are emerging maybe from different areas, and I love communicating about what's coming, and by that I mean it's not just like a communicating like a blog post or a speech, but it's sort of putting into words the ideas that people have about what's going on in the future. I've always been very, very comfortable doing that. So I think you can think of people that might have a really deep technical background, but maybe have a hard time trying to describe where that technology is going, or somebody who might be good at the description, but really doesn't have a strong background in kind of the tech and how we got to where we are. Maybe I'm a good combination of those two things. I've always really enjoyed thinking about what's coming and then talking about that, right? And just and describing that. I'm a very unusual. I mean, I studied philosophy and classics and in rhetoric and kind of in my background when I went to Berkeley. And I have to tell you, honestly, that is far and away the most practical business experience I've ever had by far. I mean, I got an MBA. That was fine. I learned a lot. I was probably, you know, one of the only MBA students that have literally never taken accounting or anything. It seemed like everybody else already had an undergraduate business degree. But yeah, so I absorbed that stuff, but honestly, not even remotely as useful as some of the thinking skills and communication skills that I got coming out of Berkeley. So I think that helped me as well. Maybe I'm just naturally predisposed that way. I don't know.
So the philosopher, and you're not the first high-tech exec who is a philosophy graduate that I've spoken to. And it's really, both my parents studied philosophy. So I'm like, I never did, but I always had that respect. So is it that it requires you to think very, very clearly? You can't just kind of waffle around the argument. Is that
right? Yeah, it's, well, first of all, I think it's really, really hard. So people roll their eyes if somebody says, especially in today's STEM focused world, if somebody says, "What are you studying?" and you say, "I'm studying philosophy," and they roll their eyes. Those people rolling their eyes would just flail it's very, very difficult, but also very analytical. So if you can make your way through a Platonic dialogue, for example, that is not easy. But if you can do that and you can articulate it, that shows that you can analyze a lot of different things and kind of bring it home. Which, if you think about business, you're analyzing a lot of things and trying to bring it home, right? So I think it gives you that thinking discipline. It's a much, much, much more complicated subject than most people realize, right? So I think you get people coming out of there that are very analytical, can think about super complex things and bring them home. They can communicate that. So I'm actually not surprised. I haven't run across that many, but I know they're out there.
So what's the difference between a Platonic dialogue and a Socratic dialogue?
Well, they're one and the same because the main character is Socrates, right? So Plato uses Socrates as his character. And so the character known as Socrates is the one that's always annoying everybody and asking them questions and trying to arrive at some conclusion. He's annoying. He's arrogant. He's a great personality in literature, but he's a character in Plato.
Not a question. You can tell I haven't prepared any questions for this podcast because it definitely would not have included that question. But it's fascinating. So I want to wrap this up to make sure that we have room for the rest of the discussion.
Sure.
But going back to strategy, what are the key elements? You know, you talk to someone and they say, "Oh, we have a strategy for this." Strategy is a word that is bandied around very loosely. What are the key elements of a strategy in your mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a strategy, it's kind of like what is the modus operandi of the company? And by that I mean, what is the pitch? And then why are you pitching that, right? What is the product that supports the pitch? And okay, now you're at the product level. Well, why is that product what the customer actually needs? What's the value, the ROI that the customer is deriving from that product that you just pitched, right? So you're kind of getting through those layers, high, low. You're sort of starting high level, like we're focused on computer vision. And then you're talking about the product. Okay, how do you actually bring that to life? And then you get to the customer. Why does the customer actually need that? What's the business problem that's actually being solved? I think if you start the other way, a lot of people will just focus on the business problem, but which is fine. But, you know, again, back to Steve Jobs, where he famously said, you know, if I ask customers what they want, then I would never have built the iPhone or I wouldn't have built the iPad because they weren't telling me that's what they needed. What they really needed was information more quickly, information on the fly. That was the real need. Right. So then he backed into, you know, the product and so forth. So you can kind of cut both ways. But yeah, I think it's a word that encompasses your pitch, the way that you talk about your business, the product that supports that pitch, and then the problem that you're ultimately solving for the customer. There's lots of different ways to cut it.
So, you know, the rest of, we've talked a lot about Always AI, but I'm interested in, you know, looking back on all this history, and you've seen a lot of success, and doubtless you've dealt with a lot of challenges as well. Where are you in that Steve Jobsian, not contempt, but kind of self-belief in direction? Where are you in listening to the customer and the kind of the lean startup and you have an idea of, this is the problem I'm going to solve, this is the mountain, and, you know, we're going to build it, and they're going to have a great success.
I think we're in the middle of that. Honestly, I think it's still a vision, deep learning AI and how that impacts vision. We can call it computer vision or vision AI, is still really early. It's a very early, nobody can tell you exactly how it's going to evolve, right? And if you think about it, part of the challenge is human vision, just our eyes, and arguably the most complex system that we have in our bodies. That's also really critical to our lives. I think, you know, the applications that you could build are literally what you can see, right? Okay, that's a lot. That's really big. So part of the challenge is it's so big and so encompassing. How do you chunk it down into areas that are really worthy of more focus, where machine vision and so forth would really fit? So I think the industry is still figuring this out. We're still in the middle of it. Some people are willing to take the leap, and they're more innovative, and they're kind of ahead on the curve. Other companies are a little more conservative. They know it's coming. They know it can help their business, but maybe they're not ready yet. So I think we're in the middle. We're in the middle of it.
Very interesting. Very good. Well, we come to the bit of the show where I ask you the hardest question. It's not about Socratic dialogue. It's about your three songs that have meaning for you and why. Were you able to distill it down?
Three songs. Yeah. Well, I can. Anything by anything by Bob Dylan is going to be number one for me by far. And I would take. I would pick anything from an album called Blood on the Tracks, which is a famous album, but for, you know, anybody under the age of 45, probably, like, huh? But that there's a song called Tangled Up in Blue, which is just an amazing song by Bob Dylan. I'd pick that one for sure. And then I'm a big Miles Davis fan, so I think... I'd probably pick something from Kind of Blue, like So What, or, you know, anything.
Love that.
Look,
album.
If you're on an island and you only had one album, that's probably one that you might take.
Yeah.
You said three. I don't know if it's a song, anything by the Grateful Dead, any Jerry Garcia jam that goes on for 25 minutes, I'll take that.
Well, that's good value for money. You got a choice, you might as well choose something that goes on for a long time.
Exactly.
I went to one Grateful Dead concert, but it was post Jerry Garcia. But
you don't remember it.
I don't remember it very well. It was good. Very good. Yeah. Well, Marty, thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It was really a great conversation from my perspective. I want to thank you for staying with us and listening to the whole thing and listening to the advert, if you had any. Just to remind you, all of the money from our advertising goes to the Monarch School for kids of homeless families. I really appreciate the fact that you listen and you put the hours in. I think it's an incredible industry that we work in, and so but it's important to keep up with what's going on. So thank you. Thanks to Aaron Hammack and Brooke Ellsworth for all the work they do on helping me get the podcast out, and stay safe until next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.